Well, thank you very much for your welcome. It's lovely to be here back in Yorkshire, where I belong. you can always take the girl out of Yorkshire. You can't take Yorkshire out of the girl. So the topic that you've asked me to speak about, gender and justice, of course, lends itself to a whole range of dialogues and discussions. The same title could spear a topic and a discussion in politics, in economics, in law, jurisprudence, in family studies, in a whole welter, in psychology, a whole welter of areas. And all of these things are being studied in gender studies and other departments in our universities. We could also look at it very specifically in terms of the current issues that are there in gender and justice today. And I need, from the outset, to say I'm not going to be doing that. So I'm not going to be looking at the whole transgender debate, though I'm very happy to answer questions if you want to raise these in the question time, because I'm bogged down by transgender at the moment for all kinds of reasons I'm perfectly willing to explain to you, but not I'm not going to foster it on you. Nor am I going to look at the whole issue of same-sex gender marriages and so on. Those are not my perimeter this morning. I'm really wanting to focus particularly on the whole area of gender and women. So I need to somehow or another find my own. So the focus is on women, very specifically. There we go. For all kinds of reasons. One of them is because of the Chinese proverb that we probably know, and you probably know, that women hold up half the sky, but it's the heavier half. And I think the statistics that we get in that... are, of course, very generalised statistics, but true nonetheless. When you look at the distribution of gender of men and women across the world and what they are doing, the authority they hold, the ground they cover, the roles they occupy, there's an extraordinary discrepancy, whichever culture you're looking in. And of course, in our own Western culture, it's very easy to feel that we have moved beyond this, and we have. In so many ways, we have moved to a much more egalitarian, much more place of parity and equity between the sexes in 101 different kinds of ways, including in the Church of England, one has to say. We have now 24 bishops in the Church of England, a position that was unimaginable 50 years ago. So the speed with which change has happened in these areas has been really quite vast. But I wanted to focus particularly on the whole area of justice. What is justice? Justice in the whole area of gender is not necessarily about trying to get gay rights or reproductive rights, which I'm constantly charred about by my feminist friends. They get very, very angry with me because I'm not out there promoting reproductive rights. My answer is I don't know what they are. I don't know how they could be. I don't even have any sense of meaning for the phrase itself. If you mean abortion on demand, well, there are reasons I would want to discuss that. So the way in which we tag the concept of rights against anything that we want to happen, which happens to be in our interest, is a great problem for our contemporary society, and I'm not going there, and I'm not going there in this discussion either. I'm fed up. I've sat with too many discussions where people have got very, very angry and said they feel very hurt and offended because their rights have now been violated. And my response has been, no, your rights have not been violated. We merely disagree. The concept of disagreement, which is held, I think, in a very equitable way, we can disagree in charity, we can disagree in love, we can disagree in profound respect for one another. It does not mean I'm violating your rights, I'm sorry. It means that actually you need to learn a little bit more about the English language. So the whole area then, what I'm focusing on, is the area of the some of the things I cover in the book for all kinds of reasons. The second book, it's not copy, is the American version, which is an American version. I had to rewrite it for the American audience. Interesting because, and I was glad to do so in 2018, last year, because I discovered that when I came to a passage on child brides, the whole chapter on child brides was very, very inappropriate for reasons I'll explain later. But first of all, I want to look at the whole concept of what is humanity. What are we talking about when we talk about scars across humanity, justice for humanity, gender justice in humanity? What is it? And this is where I want to give a quick theological overview, running down. You'll know all of this stuff already. And I'm aware of the fact that it's not rocket science, otherwise I wouldn't be here because I don't know anything about rocket science. But this is about theology, and the theological concepts are ones that you know about. So who are we? Fundamental question, which has echoed right through the centuries. Who are we? What is it to be a human being? And I've been recently going around schools, academies in the northwest of England, talking to people in their final year and about their curricula, and curriculum particularly in sociology, which I know quite a bit about. And I've decided to major on the whole issue of identity and the question of who we are. And it's been absolutely fascinating listening to who young people aged 17 and 18 think they are. And the image that we have from our theology, from our Christian teaching, is that we are the image of God. But the image of God is not just a kind of slogan. It actually involves so much, because we are the image of a God who is relational and love. Is there a problem here?
Whether your screen's not working.
No, it's not working. That's why I've got this screen. But yes, it would be wonderful if it were.
It's been 2 seconds.
Yes, indeed. I'll carry on. So if we're the image of God who is love and relational, that says a lot about us. It says that we too are relational. We have relationality built into our DNA, if you like. And we are dependent on God. Oh, wonderful. That's fine. I can shut mine up now. We're dependent on God. We're not autonomous. We're not freewheeling. We're not independent. We're not some kind of robotic or even self-generated being. So we are dependent. In God, we live and move and have our being, says St. Paul to the pagan Greeks. And he said that for a very good reason. He was actually raiding their own poetry and feeding it back to them. In God, we live and move and have our being. Those are not Hebraic concepts. They're Greek concepts. But Paul was using them in a profoundly Christian way. This is who we are. We're utterly dependent on the God who has made us. Even if we don't believe in God, we are still dependent on that God. And we're creaturely. We are in the image of God. We're responsible for the whole creation, but we're creaturely. We share the DNA of the rest of creation. We shouldn't get terribly alarmed about this. It worries me when people who are not scientists get terribly alarmed when we start talking about the DNA and creation. Especially when somebody points out that 98% of the DNA of human beings is found in the higher mammals. We'd expect that. This is the stuff that God has made the world of. 33% of our DNA is found in bananas. So we can't be too cocky about our standing in the universe. You know, we are creaturely. We share a common creaturehood with the rest of creation. And we're interdependent with the rest of creation. Creation needs us. We need creation. And we see the mess that we get into when we violate that interdependence, as we have been doing for quite a long time now in the whole area of climate change and creation care. But we're material also. We are sexual, we have bodies, we're matter, we're lumps of flesh walking around the universe, and we're embodied, we're gendered, male and female. And this is where usually somebody stands up and says, no, 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 we're not. And fine, if you want to stand up and say that, say it now and then sit down and we'll discuss it later on. But I'm not having an interruption in the whole talk. I'm fully aware that many people have gone beyond gender and now see ourselves as queer, bicurious, and a whole range of other things. As I said earlier, I'm willing to discuss that, but it's not part of what I believe is a theological framework. Theological framework is, by and large, the human creation is gendered or sexual or body or material in the same way in which most of the creation is also. And we're moral and accountable. We are able to choose. Of course, we lose that ability to choose when we become undergo addictions, and we have to fight against those, because what addiction does is take away our ability to choose. It puts us in bondage, but we are able to choose. We are accountable for the choices we make, for the actions we do, the thoughts that we think, and so on. We're accountable to ourselves, to each other, and of course to God. And we're responsible. We are the guardians of creation. We're the stewards. We're the guardians of the young. We are in loco parentis, in the place of the great parent to all the young that we produce. We are responsible for our neighbours. We are to show neighbour love, whether those neighbours are thousands of miles away or in the next street or next house, and so on. And we're also spiritual. We have eternity in our hearts, as one poet put it. We don't believe, we can't believe that we have 3 score years and then 10 and then we're snuffed out. Actually, if that were the case, half of us wouldn't be here this morning. But sorry. But we are spiritual. We believe that there's more to us than this life. There's much more, and we shall experience that more. But then the sad part of our being, who are we? We're damaged. Every human being carries about in their own body and their mind and their flesh and their emotions damaged. Damaged from the past, damaged from the present, damaged dumped on them by other people, damage that they have caused for themselves. Sin and brokenness is part also of our world, and we are all in need of healing in some area. And the wonderful thing about the Christian gospel is that it's constantly offering us healing in the areas of damage that we need. The reality of sin, therefore, is something that we need to look at. I love the word sin. I used to bang on about it when I was an Open University full-time lecturer and writing courses. They never liked me to talk about sin. They said it was a very miserable concept, and this is why they didn't like Christians. We couldn't just get out there and enjoy life. We had to keep banging on about sin. And I said, hang on a minute, you know, you and I are quite wrong about this. Because we both agree, we all agree around this table. I was with very, very, very socially conscious colleagues in the Open University, people who were worried about the politics, worried about the economics, worried about the structure of society. They really were. They lost sleep at night about it. And I said, we all agree that the place is in a mess. Everything is in a mess. We need a lot of changes in our world to make it fair and equitable. But here's the difference between us. If you're saying this is the very best human beings can do, we're doomed. We're finished. We've had it. If I'm saying, but this is a result of sin, then there's always a possibility of redemption. There's possibility of change, renewal, and forgiveness. They never agreed with me, but they agreed that sin wasn't that bad a concept after all. What is sin then? First of all, of course, it's alienating. It cuts us off. It cuts us off from God. And that's the fundamental nature of sin. Once we're cut off from God, then we're in danger of being cut off from everybody and everything else. Cut off from other people cuts us off from ourselves. We don't really know who we are. We believe our own propaganda. We move into fantasy world. We actually live in denial. We think we're somebody, but we know we're not deep down. So this cutting off, this alienation is deep in the whole area of sin. And of course, from the rest of creation, we think of the rest of creation as our playboy, our play place, something that we can use and abuse for our own purpose. Sin is also destructive. It tears down, it can never build up. It always destroys, always hurts and harms. It's distortive. That means it takes truth and twists it. Takes truth and truth suddenly becomes half-truth or quarter-truth or fifth truth or no truth at all or downright lies or truth is what I say it is, irrespective of any evidence out there. And we are precariously close to that in international politics right now. Truth is what I say it is. Bang the evidence. And the evidence is just fake news or something very similar. Dangerous world to be in, because actually this is one of the biggest powers of sin, the distortive nature of truth. And it's addictive. It becomes part of us. It controls us. We lose our freedom. It becomes habitual in our lives. This is the only way we can operate. And once you've moved into this schedule, it's very hard to step back and say, okay, I got it wrong. I am a sinner. I did tell lies. I did make that up. I did exactly what I am accused of. How many times do we hear that in public life today? It's much more that we hear the denial, no, it's wrong, and we have lengthy and expensive court cases to prove what everybody knows is the case, because actually the addictive nature of sin means that you can't let go of it. And it's generational. This is a terribly sad thing. Passes down through generational lines, not necessarily through DNA. It's much more through learned practice, from being surrounded by patterns of behavior. And so if your parents or if your father or your grandfather was a thief, it's quite likely that thieving becomes part of the whole generational structure. If there was violence in your family, you have to fight very hard against it in your own life. If your parents were kind of unfaithful, if you're, I was with a breakfast meeting, a prayer breakfast meeting, and one of a well-known Christian leader, we were all asking very personally one another for prayer. And this man said, I would like you to pray against my penchant for adultery. Well, I nearly fell off my chair. Anyone less likely to commit adultery was this guy. I mean, he was just such a straight, lovely, honest person that you'd never think twice about being in his company or anything. And I sort of thought, why are we praying that this guy won't commit adultery? And then it hit me. I said, what was your father like? He said, yeah, he had it off with so many women, and my mother forgave him and forgave him, and eventually the marriage broke up. And your grandfather, the same. What about your brothers? Brother's gone through three marriages, now living with a woman who's prized away from another marriage. My uncle's the same. Suddenly you realize why he needed prayer, not because he was an adulterer, but because it was a generational line. He'd lived with it, been part of his social surroundings, everything that he knew about life. Generational sin is something that I believe that only the Holy Spirit ultimately can break the chains of in our lives, and we need to be in constant prayer for that and for our children, that our sin will not pass down to them and they will not reproduce the things that we have not got mastery over in our own lives. And it's structural, it corrupts justice, it enslaves other people, and of course it's societal. It gets embedded down in practices, in institutions, in values, in ways of doing things, in media, in ways of permeating news and so on. And it's delusory. It's self-justifying. It rewrites injustices. We eventually end up believing our own propaganda. And it's insistent. It changes needs into demands. That's sin. It's not really about sex at all. Sex is just the kind of thing that we've somehow got lulled into identifying with sin so that we don't get the big picture, so that we can actually be distracted from seeing the power of sin in our society and in the world as a whole, and then we don't do anything about it. It's manifested actually in exploitation, it's manifested in tyranny, it's manifested in a million different forms of injustice, in partiality, in violence, in global oppression, especially of the vulnerable. The vulnerable usually pick up the tab for sin in our culture. The vulnerable are the ones who actually suffer most. And one of the, I believe, the church's prophetic callings is to discern the structures of sin in our world as a whole, and the whole structures of dehumanization, and to address them. And I don't think we're terribly good at that calling. Sometimes we do it from a self-righteous point of view, sometimes we do it from a very judgmental point of view, and then nobody listens because they don't want us passing judgment on them when we've got so many problems in our own backyard. But this is still our calling, and we have to do it in humility and with grace. Redemptive theology, then, this is the point I was making earlier, part of our understanding of what it is to be human and what theology and justice are about is that sin does not have the last word, and that it's the very life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ which offers us forgiveness, gives us peace with God, wipes our sin out, brings us healing, new life, and a new future. And that's a fundamental message that the gospel, that the church has to proclaim. And it's such a powerful message, and it's heard so little today, because really the message that people are often hearing from the church is, it didn't really matter anyway, that wasn't that bad, we got it terribly out of perspective, it wasn't really sin. In fact, it's all acceptable. And I think rather than that, we have to recognize that sin is sin, but Christ is Christ, and forgiveness is there, and its effectiveness is there for all of us. And redemption issues in new ways of living, which involve intercession for ourselves and for others. Jesus at Gethsemane told his disciples, pray for yourself. As he went off and sweated blood, pray for yourselves, pray for yourselves. You will not enter into temptation. It wasn't interesting that he didn't say, pray for me, that I will have the strength to withstand the power of the devil as I now go forward into the death I must die, but pray for yourselves. And I think that's a message that God gives us too. Pray for ourselves, that we might be interceding, that we will too issue our redemptive living in new ways, putting the good news into action. So finally, back to my topic, when the lecture really ought to be finishing, I'm just starting, that justice is part of redemptive living, and seeking justice is part of redemptive living. The rest of what I want to do is I want to romp through where in a whole area of gender, there are issues of justice that need to be addressed. This is a romp because we don't have time to go into it in any detail. This little little kind of circle there is, I raised the question, I started to write the book Scars Across Humanity when I'd been to the Congo and seen such atrocities that no human being ought ever to see, of violence inflicted on women, rape as a weapon of war and so on. And I started to ask where in the, taking the concept of a global woman, where in the life cycle of a global woman is violence most likely and injustice most likely to occur? And of course, if you read the sociology books or the criminology books, it's always between 16 and 59, that big chunk of productive life in a woman's life cycle. My discovery was completely different. It's all the way through. It's from the womb right through to old age. And the whole idea that there is a particular part of a woman's, a global woman's life when she's more likely to suffer injustice or violation is actually statistically accurate, but methodologically untrue. It's all the way through. And so there you have this chart of looking at it, starting from selective abortion, onto female genital mutilation, child brides, another name for child abuse, when little girls are married off into harem at the age of 10, honor killings, intimate partner violence, often used to be called domestic violence. Domestic violence is a broader term, covers all the violence that goes on in the home. And then trafficking and prostitution, which I put together. That was probably the most controversial chapter, oddly enough, the chapter I've got most stick about, but I'll tell you about that later. And then rape that we all know about, and sexual violence in war, which I had then encountered. And I want to go through the patterns of gender injustice that you get in all of these areas. So I want to do it quickly so that you'll have some time afterwards. And then we're helped by actually recognizing that right in our own place, if you like, our own culture, these issues are just behind us, just in front of us, and just the side of us. It's not just a developing world issue. It's not just an issue where people have not yet come into a civilized whole and know how to behave. In fact, even in our own culture, the growth of pornography, the growth of violent computer games, and I've been doing some research with the Indian Orthodox, who've done a tremendous amount of research on violent computer games. Monks in these Orthodox seminaries, you think that they're just there to pray. They're not, actually. They're there to do research on violent computer games, and they've done some fantastic stuff and have been sending it to me, and I'm very grateful for it because it's stuff that we have not yet done in our own culture. Street harassment, everyday sexism, and so on. So it's nurturing and normalizing violation. And this is the YouGov survey just a month ago, where their final conclusion was girls and young women are growing up in the UK being exposed to unwanted sexual attention, harassment, and so on. And if you look at the ones that get to the criminal, the courts and so on, they're growing all the time. The highest ever record was last year, which had really virtually burst the banks. And even in 2007 and 8, the statistics, the recording of the statistics changed, and all of these other categories started to come into gender offences and the whole idea of injustice towards women on the base violence, FGM, rape, and so on. So bit by bit, we're recognising in our own culture that there are layers of injustice that women are exposed to, and men too, but to a very different level, and we'll talk about that in a minute, which we need to address. But on a global level, they're vast. So I split it up into two groups, and that's against the girl child, which is a particular horrible form of injustice because the girl child has almost no way of actually fending for herself. Adult women can club together, can work together, can campaign together, can have Me Too programs, can actually bring things to court and so on. The girl child is trapped, and her her vulnerability is something that really ought to draw the heart out of us. So I just want to go through very quickly my own findings and those others. Way back, 10 years ago now, The Guardian, that's not known for getting its knickers in a twist about abortion, wrote this article, and I mean, this is where it started my own interest in looking at it. So they found that all of these dozens of babies exhumed from a pit outside abortion clinic. And what was happening was that they were aborting girl babies. And the research that's been done on that by people like Sabu George, a doctor, campaigner, a journalist who's given his life really to campaigning against sex selective abortion in India has just been amazing. He's talking about a massive number of deaths, and the numbers are astronomical now. He describes the first few months in the womb as the riskiest part of a woman's life cycle in India, and the sex ratio is getting worse every day. Almost everywhere you go in rural India, you'll find abortion clinics. As long as you can get a bullock cart down a really rickety road, which has got a scanning machine on it, you can actually open up an abortion clinic. And this is what India's Ministry of Development says just a few weeks ago. 2,000 girls in India are killed every day, with many slain just before or just after birth. Horrendous. So what are they doing about it? And the sad thing is very, very little. And that's they can name it, but actually they're not stopping it. And the posters are like this: spend 500 rupees now and save 50,000 rupees later. What does that mean? And they could, lots and lots of issues that they will do. This is one of the government posters: save girls, save family. Girls bring happiness at home, so that young women thinking of aborting their girl babies will be stopped. Actually, young women are not thinking of aborting their girl babies. That's not what it's about. And actually, the government knows that's not what it's about. What it's about is actually cracking down on the pharmaceuticals, cracking down on the people who are producing the scanning machines, cracking down on the technicians and the doctors who are operating this very lucrative business, and actually putting them in prison or bringing costs. And they're not doing that. When I visited a part of India where the only part of India where sex selective abortion was not practiced, it was a completely different story. Here we are, and the man on the right in white is the local young Catholic priest, and he wanted me to get together with the young women and the young men. These women, if they had been in any other part of India, would not be alive today. They would have been aborted because they're all second or third daughters to families which have already got a lot of children. In fact, they carried on being alive. They weren't aborted. They were educated. Many of them have got doctorates. They're a highly literate group of women. And so, but of course, then, of course, the marriage age comes. So the reason why there's such a heavy number of sex-selective abortions is, of course, the dowry. Because the dowry means that the bridegroom's family has to receive a very, very large amount of money, or a yacht, or jewelry, or down payments, and then debt for the rest of their lives in order to take the bride for their son. And the more educated and the more affluent the son is, the higher the dowry requirements are. And so they're a marriageable age now, and what do they do about the dowry? There's no money left, no dowry, just all of these daughters with PhDs, etc. And so this great young priest has this marvellous idea. Hang on a minute, down the road there's this fishing village, a fishing village full of completely illiterate fishermen who've never been to school, but they know how to fish. They're not numerate, except they can count the fish as they come in, they can do economic calculations, and they need brides. They need brides. They're not particularly interested in the dowry, they just want women at home and so on. Why don't we get the two families together? They're Catholic, after all. Let's get these two Catholic wings of our church together and get them married off, which is precisely what they did. But there was a sting in the tail. And the sting in the tail was the men that carried on being really nice fishermen, the women that carried on having professional lives, and never the twain met in a family sense. And so the vicar, the priest, thought this was a bit wrong. Then the men ought to try a bit harder. They ought to at least go to his literacy classes, which he was pushing like mad, and his numeracy classes, and learn to be actually worthy of their wives. So I was to go into the men's group and persuade them to join the the priest's literacy classes, and then I was going to women's group and share all that I knew with them. Well, this is the men, some of the men who were the fishermen married to these women. I went into the men's group, and it was all through translation, and one of the guys said, okay, look, we know why you've come. You've come to get us to join the vicar's, the priest's literacy classes. We're not going to do it. We'll just tell you that at the beginning. We're not going to do it. We're fishermen. I know how to fish. I'm really a good fisherman. I can catch any kind of fish. But once I'm going into his classes, I'm completely de-skilled. I become an idiot. I feel a fool. I'm not going to do it. So they all kind of said the same. And there was I standing there like a lemon. So I said, yeah, I understand that. What am I going to tell the priest when I go back? That I failed. You know, I hate being a failure. So I'm going to have to go back to this priest and say, look, I tried my hardest and I failed. And this chap says, well, that would be a lie because you haven't tried at all. So I said, okay, well, what do I do to try? And just give me some help on this because I need to know how to try to persuade you to go into the literature classes. So he said, well, you need us to give us 5 good reasons why we need to read and write. You know, I can do everything I need to fish. So I said, well, you know, your wives are reading these really interesting things on the computer. And this guy said, oh, I know all about computers. I can do computers. So I said, if you've got computer language, you've got your own language. Anyway, we had a little discussion about it, and we had a very entertaining time. But then before I left, this chap stood up and said, there's one thing we haven't told you yet. I said, go on. He said, we really admire our wives. We think they're amazing women. You know, we can't believe our luck in having women like this. And it's not about cooking and looking after the children. It's about being dignified women. And we are over the moon. So go and tell your priest that, he said. Let them know that we're not kind of complacent about it. So I went into the women's group. And I said I'd just been sent to the men to tell them to join the literature classes. They all had a good laugh and so on. And the women said, no, they're not going to do it. It would be nice if they did. It would be nice. You know, it would be nice to have a bit more education and they could encourage their sons and so on. But we love them the way they are. You know, no woman was disgruntled about her husband. They were happily married. And actually, I'm not surprised. The men were very, very dishy guys. I mean, really, really super guys. And you got good marital harmony. They knew what it was about and they got on with it. That's a local way of dealing with the issue. It was a good way. It was a Christian way. It was a theological way, if you like. Get families together and center it on the teachings of the church and marital faithfulness and love and troth and commitment and equality. But a bigger way, of course, is to address the big structural inequalities from a legal point of view. I'm stuck for some reason. I can't get any further. Can you help me on this one? It's... Yes, we're moving. Okay, I want us to move on faster because I'm taking such a long time. You know a lot about FGM. Put your hands up if you don't know anything about FGM. Female genital mutilation. Okay, well, up to 200 million. 200 million, just try and get that figure in your mind. Women worldwide have undergone FGM now. And 3 million girls are estimated to be at risk from genital cutting every year. It's 28, but now 26. Mostly African countries, but with migration, the problem is happening everywhere. It's happened in Britain. We had one conviction last year of a mother who had taken her girl to be cut. And so you find that it's happening in North America, Australasia, and Europe. The numbers in our own culture is something like 140,000 women are living with the aftermath of FGM in Britain alone, and 10,000 girls are likely to be cut if we don't stop it by being taken home next year. It's often, nearly always, not always, done on minors. It's done without proper instruments, and there are 3 or 4 main forms of FGM. The least invasive form, clitoridectomy, is just cutting off the clitoris. Excision takes the labia around the clitoris, and infibulation, or sometimes called the phoronic type, cuts deeply into the vagina, taking away all of the genital material and then stitching the child or the girl up so that she just has a tiny hole for menstrual blood to pass through and urine. And something like 15% of all FGM is of this type. It's barbaric, it's brutal, there are no known health benefits whatsoever, and the impact is horrendous. It's infective, excessive bleeding, all of these things are happen straight away. Many girls die in the actual procedure itself. When are they opened up? They're opened up after marriage on their wedding night. I've talked to young men whose job it is to cut their brides open and then have sex with them, and opened up again for delivery of a child. Is this an enjoyable experience, opening your bride up? No. Is this an experience being opened up and having sex? It's horrendous. Most of the women I've talked to, through interpreters, admittedly, have told me that this is supposed to be the most exciting time of their life, but actually it's a most painful and ghastly period. It's a violation. It's injustice writ large on the human rights of a girl and women. And it actually talks about, the act itself talks about the violation. Why does it persist? What's it all about? And it's interesting because it's one of those areas that actually it persists because there were women cutters. Women are the ones who keep the practice going. Elderly women, grandmothers and so on, because they're afraid that their granddaughters of that generation, they went through FGM, and if they don't, their grandchildren don't go through, nobody will want to marry them. Why will nobody want to marry them? Because somehow or another, the girls are then suspect. And I was told in Ethiopia, when I was visiting a whole bunch of women there who were Muslim women, that if they hadn't had genital cutting, then their clitoris was growing longer than male penis, would be dangling between their legs, and they would be very promiscuous women. I'm trying to explain that I didn't have a penis dangling between my legs, I was not at all promiscuous, I'd never been genitally cut, was very difficult, because they had never met a woman who had not gone through FGM. Mainly, it's about controlling the girl's sexuality. That's what it's about. The girls are not entitled to have sexual pleasure. It's bad for them to have sexual pleasure, because if they have sexual pleasure, they'll run after it. It's bad for them to actually have any kind of sexual encounter except with their husbands. Their husbands can have as many sexual encounters as they wish, but they have to marry a girl who is pure and whom they can cut open. And so this sense of this inequality in terms of understanding the sexuality and the politics of it, and of course money. Money's there because the cutters have paid an enormous amount of money, far more than most people will be paid. And it's all because of the patriarchal notion that that women's sexuality must be controlled by men. By men, first of all, by their fathers, and then by their fathers-in-law, and then by their husbands. In Somalia, some tribes in Somalia, the girl's body has to be inspected by her future parents-in-law before they will allow their son to marry her. And the indignity of that, imagine having to lie down so that they can inspect whether or not you've ever been tampered with. And this is about the money. And of course, there are protests all over the world that this is incredibly unjust. Gender injustice completely stops with FGM. And we've now got some interesting movements in our own country. I was with a girl who was leader of a whole movement just 2 days ago, a young, gorgeous girl called Nemo, who got an OBE from our own government, the Queen, because of her work on FGM. I know Hibo Wadri, who has written a book called Cut, describing her own experiences. And they're really asking, why aren't Christians standing alongside us? Why aren't they getting very worried about all of these issues? Why is it just left to us to be doing things for gender justice in this area? And my answer is because we're frightened of being called racist. We're frightened of standing up and saying this is a barbaric process, because the moment we do, somebody is going to say, you are white, you don't understand, you're kind of tramping on our feet, you're a racist bunch, and we're not. And she said in response, Hibo said, but if this was happening to little white girls, you'd be going crackers, you'd be screaming your heads off, there'd be a safeguarding issue, you'd have the police and you'd do everything. But because it's happening to us, you're just sweeping it under the carpet. That's no longer true. It's now much more open. It's been happening in schools are now informed. There are practices in schools and colleges for reporting, and people can be taken to court. Very quickly, the third thing I looked at was early enforced marriages, child brides. The reason I had to rewrite for this for America was I found that, of course, the highest rate of child brides is in places like Nigeria. But America is probably the biggest of all the Western countries that practices child marriage. So there were some girls as young as 10 getting married in America. And as many states, I think it's almost half the states in America, have no minimum age for marriage. Now imagine what's all that about. I haven't got time to go into it in great detail. But you get the figures again, 40,000 forced into marriage every day, 70,000 dying in labours because their bodies aren't ready to have children. The moment they become pubescent, then they have children. And all of these risks in pregnancy, risk to the babies, loss of education, financial dependency, and so on. All of these are areas of injustice faced by the girl child alone. And even here in our own country, between 5,000 and 8,000 people are at risk of being forced into marriage every year. The forced marriage helpline, people phoning in because they're anxious about being taken back to Pakistan, is actually reinforced by lots of organizations like Karma Nirvana. Put your hands up if you've heard of this organization. A woman called Jasvinda, an Asian woman who herself ran away from home rather than married. Her sister was married off and eventually committed suicide because she couldn't cope with the violence in the marriage. She now has this organization protecting Asian girls and other girls in communities who are frightened of being married against their will or being having honor attacks and so on. So lots of things are happening. We're in contact with and we're partnering with Jasminda. And then there are honor killings, horrendous, horrendous. I mean, I can't even begin to describe what it's like to be in cultures where this is a norm. This is a typical thing, a woman found to be dishonoring her family, might be buried up to her neck and then stones thrown at her until she eventually just dies. And stoning is the perfectly normal and acceptable form of honor killing in many areas in the North Africa and the Middle East. And the police will decide the stoning should take place on members of her own family. Her father has, and her uncles are usually the ones who cast the first stone. And they're brought before courts that are run by men. And so the figures are huge. We've no idea how many kind of people are being killed in honor killings across the world. Predominantly they're men, they're women, they're also men, of course. Anybody who steps out of family mores and family lines. The frightening thing is that the University of Cambridge did this study about 4 years ago where they went to Amman and studied teenagers in Jordan City. And we couldn't believe the results. Almost half the boys and one in five of every girl believed that if the person had dishonored their family, then it was perfectly justified that killing a daughter, a sister, or a wife was acceptable. That was perfectly justified. They should not, that the honor of the family came higher than the death of the person that they were related to. And a third of all teenagers involved in the research advocated honor killing. So it's not even going out with generations. And these are children in the capital city, and many of whom were educated young people. So it's a frightening thing, an area. Now, I haven't got time to go into all of the other areas. I just wanted to touch quickly on trafficking and prostitution and then go back. So again, we've got the massive area of trafficking. Christians have woken up to the injustice in trafficking. Looking at the numbers of trafficked women and girls. Again, the majority of trafficked people are women and girls. Boys and men are trafficked, usually for forced labor, sometimes for organs, sometimes for armed services. Women and girls are nearly inevitably trafficked for sex or for sexual services. And all of these things are happening, and there are new organizations and initiatives trying to change it. But actually, the reality is that trafficking goes on. So, oh dear me, I think we've gone askew here. It's got out of that. I'll go back to trafficking in a minute, but we'll just want to mention some of the intimate partner violence. Intimate partner violence happens right across the world, including in our own culture. If anything, it's getting worse in the UK. We are a more violent society domestically than almost anywhere in Europe. And yet we're not signing the European protocols. Well, we've signed the European protocols. We haven't ratified the Istanbul Convention in order to put zero tolerance into practice. And of course, male victims are also gender victims of domestic violence. And so the issue is huge. We're back onto trafficking and prostitution. So this is a... there we are. So that's a pie chart, a 10-year ago pie chart, but you can see the way in which women and girls occupy the largest groups. That ratio is slightly different now. You'd find far more boys in the ratio than there. And the big question is, why do we make a big fuss about trafficking as we do now in the Christian church as an issue of gender justice, but not prostitution? And I want, this is where I'm wanting to stop, and I'll stop the lecture here and leave it with you. We have lots of categories. They're moral categories that go on in our head. And sometimes we really need to rethink them from a theological and also from a sociological and practical point of view. So what is prostitution and what is trafficking? And we've now agreed that people who are trafficked are victims. They are taken from the place that they belong to a place they don't belong to against their will, and they're forced into acts against their will, and they become effectively slaves. Either slaves to forced labor or slaves to sexual practices. But prostitutes are people who choose what they want to do with their lives. And in fact, this myth has been supported by prostitution, people in prostitution themselves, and of course by legislation and by brothels and so on. So the moment what happens in the UK is that it's free. You may run a brothel, you may sell sex in your brothel, and that's fine, but you may not solicit on the streets. If you do solicit on the streets, then you can be picked up by the police and you can be convicted, because that's actually offensive, and it's illegal. And what has gone on is that women who have been on the streets from teenage years right through to the 20s have amassed such convictions, an arm long, a woman called Fiona Broadfoot brought this to the High Courts in London 2 years ago, that there's no way she will ever spend her convictions. It would take her several lifetimes to spend these convictions, because between the ages of 14 and 26, when she quit prostitution, she quit at 29, but she stopped soliciting on the streets at 26, she has now amassed so many convictions. So the issue is, why should it be illegal? Why criminalize a prostitute has been the big issue. And so the Amnesty International and many other organizations say, let's not criminalize a prostitute. Let's simply not regulate prostitution. Let's simply acknowledge and accept that this is a form of work that women choose to do. And it's their choice. It's their choice what they do with their own bodies. And so their argument, particularly the one of Amnesty International, and I think it's been taken in on this one, is that we go for deregulation and non-criminalization, but actually safe zones. So prostitutes may solicit in safe zones, and then the rest you just close down. The interesting thing is, the people who are against that are former prostitutes. Prostitutes who have organized themselves in groups called Exit, and this is one of them, where they're making the statement this. Our critique of prostitution is not moralistic. We don't condemn or infantilize women who are involved in it. We argue it's a patriarchal institution through which women are marginalized, abused, stereotyped, and objectified. And that group is getting very much bigger. Girls are not commodities, because they're arguing that the law needs to change from where we have at the moment, from criminalizing the prostitutes, but not to deregulation. Rather than making it illegal to sell sex, make it illegal to buy sex, which is the Nordic model. And I'm 100% behind this. I've been campaigning recently with a whole bunch of other people, because that actually has made a huge change in the countries where it's been put. So in Norway, in Sweden, Australia, Canada, Ireland, I think even, I mean, they're arguing about it in France. But so being a prostitute is legal, but buying sex from a prostitute, it's not legal. And that concentrates the mind a great deal. Why do I think that this is important to do this? Because my experience, and I've spoken to now hundreds of prostitutes or women who are in prostitution. I'm part of an international Christian alliance on prostitution and also part of initiatives in this country where we're looking at gender and justice and prostitution. And the vast majority of women in prostitution are there not because they've chosen it as a way of life, but they have been trapped in, often as adolescents, often from very poor backgrounds, very unhappy backgrounds, running away from school. They've been pimped, they've been picked up, they've been groomed, they've been put there, and there's no way out. It's almost a trap that lasts for a lifetime. So I think the whole area, if you're looking at gender justice, something that's worth fighting for today, I believe that this is an area of moving our legislative framework forward. When Fiona Bortfoot took her case to the High Court last year, a year before last, they did not know what to do about it. She asked for her convictions to be expunged, to be spent, so she could get on with the rest of life. She is now 41. She hasn't been able to do a college degree. She hasn't been able to take any job that involves children. She hasn't been able to study for a whole range of areas because of these convictions for prostitution. Her argument was, I never chose prostitution. I was picked up on the streets by a pimp who then groomed me, and actually I was enslaved into this until I helped to run away. The High Court didn't know what to do with it. It took 2 weeks to actually think about it. At the end of the day, it came back and expunged her convictions, which has actually changed the whole nature of the way we see prostitution. I was giving a woman's talk in a big feminist meeting. Women's meeting, feminists are split down the middle. There were those mostly there on the Nordic model side, very, very definitely. But there were a small group of career prostitutes in this meeting, and one of them was very, very offended by me and said, look, you are demeaning me. You are standing there and treating me like an infant, treating me like an irrational woman who doesn't know what she wants to do with her own body. So I said, well, explain yourself to me then, and I will try not to in any sense offend you or treat you wrongly. She said, prostitution for me is a career. I'm a sex worker. I'm not a prostitute. I'm a sex worker. My work is on the streets. My work is in sex. I supply sex for men who want it. I've chosen to do this, and I get a good living from it, and I don't want to be demeaned by you. So I said, okay, so it's your career. So now I said, now I have problems with this concept of career, because if you're telling me that you've weighed up all the options, you know, I've thought about HR, nursing, human resources, maybe technology, what about theatre management? And oh no, I think I'll go for prostitution. I said, I don't believe you. I've not met anybody else who's actually gone through that format of thinking through careers and opting for prostitution. And I said, and if it is a career, why are we now not sending careers advisors into schools saying, and of course, there's always prostitution, if you'd like to actually look at all the options available to you? I said, so career is the wrong word. And she, okay, well, not a career, maybe not a career then. She said, but it's a choice, it's a choice. So I said, yeah, and choice also involves other concepts. So in order to choose, we have to be free to choose. And we're free to choose when we have the ability and non-constraints pushing us in certain directions. So I said, I'd love to sit down with you and have a long conversation to find out where your freedom has been and where your freedom has been curtailed. And she said, I don't think I want to continue this discussion with you, says this woman. So she said, you just have to believe me. This is my choice. This is my way of life and so on. And I don't want to be demeaned by you. So I said, fine, let's agree with that. I have no problem with that. Let's shake hands on it. But may I make one more point? That for every 10 of you for who this is a career and this is a choice, there are 10,000 other women in prostitution for whom this is not a career and this is not a choice, and we desperately need to help them to get out. Will you at least agree with me on that? Will you show some compassion for them? Bless her heart, she did. She just nodded. She said, yes, I can work with you on that. And in fact, that's where most of the radical feminists in our culture are. Radical feminists gets a very, very bad name because it's very anti-men. It's usually run by bunches of very fierce lesbians, and I met them all, and they're wonderful women, and they don't like men, that's quite true. But actually, their love for women and their love for justice and their concerns about gender are very, very, I would say, extremely high writ in the moral kind of canopy of what we stand for in our country. And I mean, sometimes they make me smile. So it was a woman called Harriet Wislich, who is the partner of one of the fiercest lesbian feminists called Julie Bindle, who's written this book called The Pimping of Prostitution and has traveled the world talking to prostitutes and has tried in every culture to get exit possibilities, to get women out of prostitution into free work, into release, away from bondage into release. And she uses these words, bondage and release, bondage and release. They have no time for the church, they have no time for Christianity because they think we're wet, as does a woman called Karen Ingalls Smith, who has a web page called Counting Dead Women. And she keeps a record of all the women who have been killed by their partners or former partners in this particular month and next month and so on. And the passion of these people is really quite extraordinary. And having been working with them now for 3 or 4 years, I realize there's so many bridges that we need to build in the Christian church. I mean, not only are they very hot on prostitution in terms of getting justice in those areas, they're equally concerned about transgender issues, people becoming purporting to be women when actually they're still male in their anatomy and so on, and then they end up often, some of them, not all of them by any means, abusing women. They're even challenging surrogacy and the whole areas like that. So the conclusion, and I haven't got time to finish the lecture because it's already way over, is that there are many, many issues about gender and justice. First of all, we've got to get our theology right. It's very easy to get our theology wrong, to nitpick one or two isolated verses from the New Testament, and I've got those on the slides, but I haven't got time to look at them, to misunderstand what Paul is saying in those chapters, to actually have the wrong view of gender in our own theology, and to fail to recognize that we are caught together in the scriptures. The four words are used over and over again to describe the relationship between men and women and justice. And that is a similarity. We are like each other. We are incredibly like each other. We're the same in most of our needs, most of our desires, most of our sins, most of our kind of longings. And then we're different. We are fundamentally different, men and women. We are different anatomically. We're different in terms very often of our psychology. We're different in the way that we operate. We're different in the way that we're interested. Even communication patterns are different. And then the third one is complementarity. We fit together. It's part of the human race that men and women fit. There's a fit both obviously in the whole act of procreation, but there's a fit in that we need one another for the wholeness of the human race. But the fourth concept is that of union, that we are there united as the body of Christ, united as the bride of Christ if we're in the fellowship of believers, united in our sin and our brokenness and so on. And those four concepts are used interchangeably all the way through the scriptures. If we just build a theology on one of them, like difference, we end up with hierarchies. We end up with women demeaned. We end up with women as a lower caste. We end up with authority and subjugation. We can't do that, and the scriptures don't allow us to do that. If we build it on just another one, our sameness or similarity, we miss the whole aspect of difference between men and women. And we fail to understand why we can't talk to each other. It's taken my husband and I 50 years. We just married, celebrated our golden wedding last year, and we had a long discussion as to why communication had been so queer all the years. And I said, it's because you're a man. So we can't build a whole theology on sameness because there's more to it than that. And similarly, if we build a theology on what we call complementarity, that would be fine if it were complementarity, but mostly it's hierarchy. And the complementarians, so-called, I think are misnamed because they're really hierarchicalists. And if we build it on union, then we're on safer ground, but we're missing out on these other concepts. Biblical theology then offers us these incredible a sweep and breadth of understanding of our gender, and it's really applicable in our culture today. It just needs us to get out there and start the ball rolling. I'm sorry I've taken so long. I'm only halfway through the presentation.
Thank you, Elaine.
Can I also mention, I'm an ambassador for an organisation called Restored, and they have recently done a survivor's handbook for domestic violence, and I brought two with me, and I'll put them on the bookstore. Yes. If it's really, really helpful, get it from them direct. But if you know people who are struggling with domestic violence or intimate partner violence in your church, the survivor's handbook is a lifeline, and it's written for Christians.